Whose election is it anyway? This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Russian hackers are suspected of stealing emails written by the Democratic National Committee. Meanwhile, a Romanian named Guccifer II claims he did it.
But when this hacker made this claim, he actually somehow revealed himself to be most likely a Russian agent as well.
Also, a reporter in Turkey worries about the government's crackdown on dissent.
Personally, I don't feel under threat, but I am very nervous for the people that I speak with, Turkish citizens.
Plus, the problem with Elena, Disney's new Latina princess.
They are trying to, like, represent as many Latinas as possible. The danger in doing that is, like, stretching the identity really thin.
Those stories today on The World. Thank you for being with us today. Plenty of drama in Cleveland last week at the Republican National Convention, a plagiarism scandal, lots of chest thumping and near constant hand-wringing about a party in crisis. Honestly, we thought the Democrats might stage a more conventional convention in Philadelphia, but this morning, California delegates were at each other's throats.
No, hold on. No.
Trump cannot win, guys.
If Trump wins this election, it's because you put somebody like Hillary Clinton on the ballot.
That's right.
Adding to the Democrats' disarray are those leaked emails suggesting that DNC leaders tried to tip the scales in Hillary Clinton's favor during the primaries. And now it appears that Russian hackers may be behind that leak. Yeah, crazy story. We'll have more on that Russian angle in just a moment. But first, let's turn to The World's Leo Hornack and Maria Muriel, both in Philadelphia covering the DNC like they did the RNC with their outsider's point of view. Maria, first Cleveland, now Philly. What's it like there? And what are the differences that you've noticed?
The biggest difference between this and what we saw in Cleveland is Trump supporters had a biker rally in Cleveland in support of Donald Trump for president. And Bernie Sanders here in Philadelphia have staged what's sort of like a fish concert. It was like jam band style, people dancing, you know, a lot of hippies, tents everywhere, and a lot of peace and love sort of thing. You know, this is starkly different when you think about it, but the truth is both groups of people have really similar language. They both say the system is rigged. They both say the establishment controls the elections. And they both have a lot of love, outspoken love for their candidate. These Bernie supporters, even though Bernie has endorsed Hillary Clinton for president, they were saying out there yesterday, I love Bernie Sanders. You know, we want Bernie for president. Just like Trump supporters last week were saying, we love Donald Trump. Their tone is very different, though. Their tone, as you can see, one of them is a biker rally. The other one is a jam band concert.
Yeah, well, thanks for that detail, because so far the DNC has been kind of eclipsed with these leaked emails showing the DNC favored Clinton. Leo, this remind you of anything?
The anger that we're seeing with the Bernie supporters does remind me of some of a similar thing that my country went through back in 2010. We had an election then in which a large proportion of the electorate were not happy with the two choices on offer. What happened then was a third party, to everyone's great surprise, leaped into popularity, and the Liberal Democrats, they're called, and they ended up actually ending up in coalition government. I think the difference here is that our system, it's a two-party system, but there is scope for third parties to have some success and to exist between elections. The real anger that we're seeing on the streets here of Philadelphia, I think, from the Bernie supporters, is that they know that all this effort they put in now goes to zero, that there's no way of carrying forward. They know this is the end, really, for Sanders as a revolution, in their words. And I think you could see that on the faces, and just the clip you played, you could see it in the faces of people, you can see it in the voices of people when they talk about how they feel this week.
I disagree with Leo. I don't think that every Sanders supporter thinks this is the end for their revolution efforts. I think actually most of them are probably still supporting Sanders, even though he has given up. He supported the establishment candidate, right? But a lot of people are still sort of rallying for him because they feel that this revolution will matter come the next election. So I think there's a little bit of a divide there among Sanders supporters and how they perceive what they're doing right now at this point.
Maria, what's been the most noticeable thing so far in these few hours that you've been in Philadelphia?
For me, it's been the absence of pro-Clinton gear. There was one person who said, oh, I thought I saw a Hillary for President t-shirt on the street, but it was actually a Hillary for prison t-shirt on the street. Leah, though, you checked out some people today. Maybe you saw something?
Well, we were trying to keep a count, actually, if we could, how long we could go before we saw some pro-Hillary merchandise or clothing. I did manage to meet someone wearing a Hillary for President badge this morning, having walked through the Democratic Convention Center for 20 minutes. Today is Bernie's day. It's true, he's speaking this evening. But we are just not seeing, at least just anecdotally, the kind of support for Hillary that she probably needs.
Well, presumably once Bernie Sanders gives his endorsement of Clinton tonight, you'll see a few more of those. You'll keep count, though. We'll have you on the lookout for Team Clinton as the week goes forward in Philadelphia. The World's Maria Muriel and Leah Hornacker there. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Thanks, Marco.
We had production help there from KCRW's Saul Gonzalez. Okay, back to those leaked DNC emails now. Thousands of emails from Democratic Party officials were leaked over the weekend, and they did not make the DNC look good. In fact, as a result, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the chair of the DNC, has announced that she's stepping down. The FBI says it's opening an investigation into the leak. Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchieri is a staff writer for Motherboard, that is Vice's tech and culture site, and he has been investigating this hack for months already. Lorenzo, take us back to when you started looking into this hack.
Yeah, essentially what we know so far is that at some point in the last few months, at least two attackers breached into the DNC networks. And according to the security company who first investigated these attacks, these two attackers have links to the Russian government, and they might be the military and the civilian intelligence service.
Yeah, that's the other big part of this headline, that it wasn't just the DNC that was hacked, but there is suspicion that Russian hackers were involved in this. What evidence have you found?
So the evidence is, like, we don't have a smoking gun. Nobody really has a smoking gun, at least. But everything that's come out so far points to Russia. The first piece of evidence is what CrowdStrike, the security company that's investigated this, found. They found that the attackers used the malware that's been previously used by Russia. Also, after CrowdStrike accused Russia, a hacker named Guccifer2 said, well, this is not true. It was actually me, a lone hacker. I've done this. But when this hacker made this claim, he actually revealed himself to be most likely a Russian agent as well. In his first message, there was, like, he used emoticons that are typical of Russian speakers. The documents that he leaked had some Russian metadata.
I gather you've actually had a chat with Guccifer2o on Twitter. Did that happen? And what did you talk about? What did you learn?
Yeah, as soon as Guccifer2 came up online and posted all these documents, he also created a Twitter account to spread the information. And so I reached out to him and I started talking to him. Initially, he was pretty friendly. You know, he made the claim that he was Romanian, but I just thought, let's ask him something in Romanian. And I used Google Translate. It took him a few minutes to respond. Afterwards, when I showed this to Romanian speakers, they were like, okay, this is definitely not Romanian. And, you know, that doesn't mean that he's Russian, but, like, this just means, you know, it's just another breadcrumb.
You're basically saying, though, that this Guccifer 2 had nothing to do with this hack.
No, I think what I believe and what a lot of experts believe is that Guccifer 2 is just a made-up persona from the actual hackers who might be Russian spies, actually.
Hillary Clinton's campaign manager said Russian hackers have been releasing these emails in order to help Donald Trump win the election. Why do you think Russians might have that as a goal?
I don't totally agree with the theory that this might be to help Donald Trump. But it's definitely clear that someone is trying to make a big splash and influence the elections by leaking documents. And that's really the big story here, you know, like, espionage campaigns and hacking campaigns to steal information are nothing new. And, you know, we can assume that the U.S. does them too. But the new thing here is the leaking of the documents and the mounting of a sort of a PR campaign with, you know, Twitter accounts, blog posts, and trying to, like, influence the elections.
But if you don't totally agree with Clinton's campaign manager that this has been done to have Donald Trump win the election, what could it be about then?
Well, no one is really sure, but it could be just that they are trying to confuse, that they're trying to spread lies. You know, everything is very confusing. And I think, you know, in a way, if this is really Russia, they've won, at least for now, at their game of deceiving us and confusing us.
Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchieri there. He's a staff writer with Motherboard, that's Vice's tech and culture site. I've got Moscow-based reporter Charles Maines with me now. So how are Russians reacting to the hack of the DNC?
Well, it's more of a curiosity here that's sort of discussed online in terms of the actual official authorities. They're, of course, not commenting on that. I don't think that's surprising when Russia's been implicated in the past in any kind of electronic eavesdropping or hacking, cyber warfare, which we've seen several examples of in the past. One person we did hear from today actually was Edward Snowden, who just noted that if Russia hacked the DNC, they should be condemned for it. But thus far, the FBI had presented no evidence.
Right. I mean, there's now been this reemergence of the notion of a bromance between Putin and Trump. Didn't Vladimir Putin clear up the fact that he never actually complimented Donald Trump?
Well, he called him a Yarky Chilik, which means sort of a colorful character, a colorful person.
Is that a compliment? You know,
well, you know, it means that he's a guy that you take notice of, but not a lot more than that necessarily. And I think Trump sort of ran with this as a very sort of genuine compliment. Apparently, you know, Trump has actually had quite a fascination with Russia over the years, at least on a sort of superficial level. He was here in Moscow to hold the Miss Universe competition, made quite a bit of money off of that, in fact, using kind of Russian sponsors to pony up the money. He's repeatedly tried to open businesses here, a Trump Tower for Moscow. It's never quite worked out for him, but he seems to always be pursuing that as well.
Aside from all that, has anyone in Moscow explained to you why Russia would want Donald Trump to win the election?
It's actually quite obvious. It's the fact that if you look at Mr. Trump's statements about NATO, particularly support to NATO allies, from the Russian side, at least from the Kremlin political side, they're very against NATO expansion. They're interested in encouraging NATO's disintegration in whatever means they can. And so just in the same way that the Russians maybe don't overtly promote Brexit, there was sort of a sense of celebration that splintering in the Western alliance was a good thing for Russia. And I think in that same way, there's a sense that if Mr. Trump did come to the White House, that this sort of splintering of the NATO allies would be a good thing for Russia as well.
Yeah, so it's less about some notion of bromance than really practical stuff like the future of NATO.
Yeah, straight out geopolitics, exactly.
How avidly are Russians following the U.S. election? And even in official circles, how much do they really understand the nuances of the American political process?
I think they're certainly familiar with the characters and some of the politicians that have gone through this motion. I mean, even Bernie Sanders had spent quite a bit of time in Yaroslavl through the sister city program that Burlington, Vermont had. And there's been some good reporting on, you know, and pictures surfacing online of Mr. Sanders in the Russian sauna in a banya here and drinking beer with locals and things like that. So, you know, I think Sanders was a bit of a curiosity to them. Trump, of course, has been the global curiosity for the circus act that he seems to combine politics and entertainment in a unique way. And in a lot of ways, I think Russians look at this and it looks very familiar to them. There's a person on the political scene here for many years, Vladimir Zhirinovsky, who is a nationalist and a member of the Duma, part of what the so-called official opposition, which isn't much of an opposition at all. He embodies some of these same traits, a combination of entertainer and circus entertainer and politician and scandalist all at once, and invoking a little bit of nationalism as well. I think for Russians, it's kind of, they look at Mr. Trump more as a version of Zhirinovsky, just one who's actually has a chance at the White House.
Journalist Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks for telling us all about this.
Thank you.
By the way, you can find all our coverage of the Democratic National Convention over at PRI.org. It's been pretty wild so far, and it's only day one. Visual documentation also over at PRI.org. Later on the show, activists in France inspired by Black Lives Matter after a young black man dies in police custody there. That's coming up on The World. In Turkey lately, it feels like the final scene in Casablanca. Round up the usual suspects. In Turkey's case, that means anyone with connections to Fethullah Gulen, a Turkish cleric here in the U.S. and an enemy of President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The Turkish government's detained thousands of people since the failed coup attempt more than 10 days ago. That includes teachers and judges, soldiers and military police. And today the government issued arrest warrants for more than 40 journalists. Reporter Dalia Mortada is in Turkey.
there's a request to detain them, about 42 journalists, basically bring them in for questioning. Some of them are prominent journalists, prominent columnists, or people that worked for media that had been overtaken by the government, actually, in the last year for their ties to the Gulen network that has been declared a terrorist network. And some of the journalists had been part of those organizations and now are being sought to be questioned.
Is this freedom of speech under attack?
Definitely, you could argue so. There are a lot of people who are more afraid to speak out, whether they're journalists or just ordinary citizens. But there has been an ongoing issue of jailing journalists in Turkey. This has been the case for decades, but especially in the last 5 years or so under the AKP, under the ruling party that has been around for a decade and a half almost. Journalists have been jailed for speaking out against the government or for investigations that put the government in unfavorable light. So this is just another side of the same coin that we've been seeing over recent years.
So, Dolly, you were in the capital, Ankara, this weekend, and you wrote that one of the things that seriously struck me was the air of fear and paranoia that hung over our heads, mine included. What is the mood in Ankara?
There is sort of this idea that if you say the wrong thing in front of the wrong people, that could end poorly for you. Because the current leadership is an Islamist government, you know, they do tie in their religious identity with their political identity, there is sort of this fear of, oh, you know, if we're joking around, we're out drinking, you know, we make political jokes and we say them in front of the wrong people, what could happen? And that's something that I've noticed an increase of in Ankara and elsewhere.
Are some people worried that Erdogan's purge, if we can call it that, is out of control?
There are people that are concerned. The people that they're rounding up, I think I read, 13,000 people have been detained. The people that they're rounding up and the people that are losing their jobs may have had nothing to do with the coup, even if they're associated with this network, the Gulen network. They had nothing to do with the coup. So critics are definitely saying that the people that are being detained, a lot of them have nothing to do with trying to overtake the government.
Will there ever come a point where people are so uncomfortable with this purge that they'll speak out, though there might be risks of that?
You know, it could happen. I think for now, since the state of emergency that's been declared is 3 months long, and people are just trying to get an understanding of what this will look like down the line, for now, people are laying low. And so a lot of people are just waiting for the storm to blow over, and they hope that that's where it'll end. The fear is that it won't end there.
Given the trend with journalists under attack, as a foreign journalist, how worried are you?
Personally, I'm not worried for myself as much as I am worried for the people that I speak with, and they're worried for themselves as well. I'm very grateful that I can always leave. I'm not a citizen of Turkey. I'm someone that can go in and out freely. Personally, I don't feel under threat, but I am very nervous for the people that I speak with, Turkish citizens, for friends and family who are Turkish. That anxiety is definitely more on my mind than it used to be.
Journalist Dalia Mortada speaking with us from Istanbul. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Okay, a serious change of pace now. You know Elsa from Frozen? Well, there's a new Disney princess in town.
I am Princess Elena.
Introducing a hero.
The Majesty of Avalor has arrived.
Who will find her?
Her Majesty Elena of Avalor. She's the first Latina Disney princess, stars in an animated TV series on the Disney Channel. Melissa Lozada Oliva is a writer and is herself Latina. She's been checking out Elena's backstory.
Elena isn't from any specific Latin American country. She isn't like specifically indigenous or Afro-Latina. She's from like a made-up Latin American kingdom where they kind of like mishmash some cultures together. They are trying to like represent as many Latinas as possible or as much of Latino identity as possible. And I think the danger in doing that is kind of like stretching the identity really thin. And in my opinion, like there is no way to like have her be everybody's princess. I think in doing that, you can erase a lot of people's identities that way.
What's interesting is that Elena, she lives in this pre-colonial fantasy land called Avalor. That would mean that she wouldn't speak Spanish if it's pre-colonial, right?
Right. Yeah.
So why is she Latina?
Exactly. Like what makes someone Latina? I think it's hard to understand a Latino or Latinx identity without acknowledging colonialism, like why we speak Spanish, why a large part of our population like is Catholic and that sort of thing. So her identity is really based in this like Disney fantasy. And I think that is kind of weird.
Do you think some viewers just won't care, that they'll be really glad that there is this character, Elena, who kind of tips into Latina world, even though technically she doesn't?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think, I mean, there's so little representation of us that I think any bit of us that resembles us a little bit, like feels like, you know, someone calling us home, definitely. Mm. And my niece is 6 years old. And she loves Disney and loves Elsa, dressed up as Elsa for Halloween.
For Frozen, yeah.
And, you know, Frozen was sort of like changed the game because of, you know, the kind of lack of romance line. And it was all about sisterhood. And there was kind of these like feminist elements of it.
Right. Girl empowerment.
Right. So, I mean, I think that was super special for my niece to watch. And I think it is going to be, I mean, even more special for her to see someone who kind of looks like her and has... and uses the language that, you know, her grandmother uses at home. And
well, contrast that with what you saw on the screen growing up as a Latina and watching various Disney characters. What was missing?
So the various Disney characters that I could like somewhat relate to, they were like gross stereotypes of culture. So, you know, for Halloween, when I would dress up as a Disney princess, it would be like Jasmine from Aladdin or Esmeralda from The Hunchback of Notre Dame or, you know, Pocahontas sometimes. You know, and when I'd play like Disney princess with my friends, like that was the princess I could be, which is weird that we like wait for Disney to tell us who we should be and what kind of costumes we should try on. But
I mean, this isn't the first time Disney has gotten other cultures wrong. They did a pretty good job of it in the 1998 film Mulan, turning American and Chinese values into kind of a hybrid train wreck, a lot of critics said.
Yeah.
Why do critical audiences, though, continue to expect more from Disney?
I don't think we should ever settle for what images like Disney puts out for us. I think we should be creating our own mirrors for our identities and ourselves. I think if there's like a lack of reflection that we see in the media, we should do something about it and we should keep criticizing it. I mean, I think I can be like all at once excited about there being a Latina princess and excited that it's going to be a TV series. However, I think I can still be critical of the way she is crafted. And I think it's impossible for one character to speak for all of Latina or Latinx identity. And I think the idea of like getting it right is also problematic. I don't know if we're something that is so easily defined.
Melissa Lozada Oliva, thank you very much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you.
Melissa Lozada Oliva wrote about Elena of Avalor for The Guardian. You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, I speak with stand-up comedian Hari Kondabolu. He talks about what it means to be mainstream and why he thinks show business is getting more diverse.
Diversity isn't because of generosity. It's because they finally found diversity to be a commodity.
More from mainstream American comic Hari Kondabolu. That's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's been a week that has rattled Germany. 4 deadly attacks in the past 7 days. 2 of them have been linked to ISIS. The other 2 appear to be lone wolf attacks, one by a Syrian who tried but failed to get asylum in Germany, and the other, the Munich shooting on Friday night by a young German of Iranian descent. Rukmini Kalamaki is a correspondent with the New York Times. She's in Stuttgart. Given that it's kind of hard to generalize about all 4 attacks, how are Germans feeling right now, Rukmini?
I think there's a general sense of panic. Obviously, this is a country that is not used to seeing these types of attacks. If you take Munich, the death toll was 10 people, which of course is significant, but it's much less than we in America have seen in school shootings, etc. And yet, as a result of those shootings, the entire city was on lockdown. The officials shut down public transportation. I arrived late that night, and it was close to impossible to even find a cab at the airport because the roads going to the airport had been shut by the government.
Also interesting is that reaction, whether it's a lone wolf attack or not, it's almost the same. There's panic, people fleeing, and immediate concerns that it has to be ISIS, and then walking it back. Has that created a sense that a lot of this is terrorism, even though it may not be?
I think we spend a lot of effort trying to disentangle whether it's inspired or directed by ISIS. But in fact, the inspired attacks are every bit as much of ISIS's strategy as the directed attacks. They've been calling for these types of killings since really the inception of the group in 2014.
So is that idea that really, when you come right down to it with ISIS, that directed attacks or inspired attacks, there's not that much difference as you see it at the end of the day? Does it complicate or maybe make easier the strategy of the German government on how to prevent attacks like anything that happened, say even the shooting at the mall in Munich on Friday?
It certainly complicates the effort, and not just in Germany, but in the U.S. Look at Omar Mateen, who was clearly somebody who was radicalized, but so far we haven't seen a direct connection to ISIS. It's very hard, as the FBI has described, to identify a person like him. It's more than a needle in a haystack. And so if they are able to project their violence in this remote way, and they're successfully doing it now, it becomes a dissipated form of violence, one that often leaves behind very few initial signals that could be used to prevent them.
You mentioned earlier that Germany has been relatively safe so far compared to places like France and Belgium. Why do you think that is?
I don't actually know why that is. Germany has one of the largest contingents of foreign fighters that have gone to Syria, many hundreds. I think it's 700 to 800. It's not far behind France and England. And yet France has seen repeated attacks and attempted attacks going all the way back to February of 2014. This week is the first set of successful attacks here. And we don't completely know why it is that their network has succeeded elsewhere and not here until now.
Has Germany been successful in thwarting attacks prior to, say, last week?
They've aggressively arrested a number of ISIS operatives, and they have foiled some attacks, but it's not completely clear to what extent the foiled attacks were truly ISIS. They were clearly jihadist, but the ISIS link to me is still a little blurry.
And Germany's had an anti-radicalization program. Do we know how well that's been functioning?
They have an anti-radicalization program led by a woman who is a real connoisseur, I'm told, of the Middle East. And her approach is a unique one. I've not seen it elsewhere. Most radicalization programs are based on trying to directly speak to the young man or woman and present them a counter-narrative through scripture, right? Mm. Her approach relies on using people that are close to the jihadist, their family members, especially their mothers, and essentially coaching those people on what to say, because those are sometimes the only links that the people going to Syria maintain. And I was just told by a German intelligence official a couple days ago that this woman's effort has resulted in a not insignificant number of German jihadists returning from Syria, which is pretty remarkable.
Yeah. The tone, as I read the reports coming from Angela Merkel and Berlin this weekend, feels like they're kind of steeling Germans for the possibility that things will continue to be bad for the near term. What do you see happening in Germany after last week?
What comes to mind is an anecdote that a journalist colleague shared with me, which is an interview that he did last night with a Syrian refugee, a Muslim, who was expressing just real angst and fright at the notion that what these few individuals have done is going to turn German society against them. And so I think it's important to remember that there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of refugees, and only a handful have resorted to these terrible acts.
Rukmini Callimachi with The New York Times. Thanks very much, Rukmini.
Marco, thank you for having me.
Germany is not the only country that suffered at the hands of ISIS recently. Over the weekend, Kabul was hit by twin suicide bombings. The blast targeted a demonstration in the Afghan capital. At least 80 were killed, hundreds injured, and ISIS claimed responsibility for the bombings. Bilal Sarwari writes for The Independent. He was in the Afghan capital at the time of the attack.
I had actually last minute canceled to go and attend. I was just on the other side of the town when it was suddenly announced that there had been an explosion. So immediately I started calling my friends who were both among the protesters and my friend from the media community. And some of my family members live in that part of the city. So it was all very worrying. And unfortunately, we soon found out that many of us were personally affected. So this was a very brutal attack that killed at least 82 people and injured more than 290 people. And what is the first time that Daesh or ISIS have managed to launch an attack, if we are to believe what the Afghan government tells us?
How were you personally affected, Bilal?
As an Afghan, I think You feel extremely sad when something like that happens, because Afghanistan is very much a very passionate affair of the heart. So as someone today said, it's a soul-crushing country in many ways. You know, we are so attached to this country. And in the meantime, we just see it being hurt time and again. But you also have to see that this was a peaceful demonstration, that this was a democratic move, that this is the story of new Afghanistan, people marching on the streets, demanding their rights, not with tanks and bullets, but through democratic means. And when that get attacks, when the younger generation gets killed, I think it hurts.
You know, this was headline news in a lot of the world, but in the U.S., where politics last week and this week seem to be dominating media coverage, it was not a big story. What do people in Kabul know about how their story gets eclipsed at moments like these?
I think it's very clear by now that the world has forgotten Afghanistan in many ways. Afghanistan is no more on the headlines because of Syria and because of other conflicts, and the people of Afghanistan feel that the country has been forgotten. Even if you look at the presence of the Western media here, there's a significant drawdown of the media, if I can call it that. People have shut their bureaus, and some people are here, but it's not the same interest when it was when you had 120,000 troops, when you had a surge. So people know that. People notice that. Because a lot of people have access to CNN, a lot of people have access to BBC World, people do notice that.
So given this one attack and the fact that a lot of people are not paying attention to Afghanistan right now around the globe, what's all this done to the nerves of residents in Kabul?
Look, I think if you go back to 2001, you had a very different country. No infrastructure, no cell phones.
When it was ruled by the Taliban.
Exactly. Afghanistan, as I've always said, was just a destroyed society, not a destroyed country. So the journey that the people of Afghanistan have started, despite all the problems here, this is a new Afghanistan, and the people of Afghanistan have built it with their lives. So now the risk is here that if these gains are not protected, Afghanistan could very easily again be a safe haven for groups like Al-Qaeda, which now the U.S. officials worry quite a lot because it's made a comeback. ISIS have a presence of a sort, and the Taliban are becoming more and more brutal. So the world will have to make a decision. It's not about making Afghanistan another Switzerland. It'll never be. You can't have a Western-style democracy here. But you also can't ignore the fact that you've got millions of children going to school. Afghanistan have governments coming through elections, even some of them fraudulent, even if there are irregularities. But you can't compare this Afghanistan to the Afghanistan of 1990s, when it was not a member of the international community.
Given that a lot of U.S. eyes are on the American election right now, I'm wondering how Afghans feel about either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump as a successor to Obama. Do they believe one option or the other will have a more profound impact on their lives?
I don't think anyone is really impressed with Donald Trump. His comments about Muslims have really been quite scary among people here, because the U.S. election is quite carefully followed here by people on local TV stations or covering that. Hillary Clinton is someone who've had an involvement in Afghanistan. She was the Secretary of the State. Before that, even when she was a senator, Afghans knew that she had an involvement here. So more people think that it'll be someone like Hillary Clinton who will not forget about this region because she knows it. She has an experience. But this is also a country that Americans have started building an attachment towards, because they've been here 14 years. A lot of Americans have got killed. They've made personal friendships. So on many levels, this is now a friendship and a journey that has been 14 or 15 years old.
Bilal Sarwari writes for the Independent newspaper in the UK. He's been speaking with us from Kabul. Thank you very much for being with us, Bilal.
Thank you. Good talk to you, Marco.
Here's a story from France that will sound sadly familiar. Recently, a young black man named Adama Traoré died during a police interrogation in a suburb outside Paris. His death has launched protests, including some nights of street violence that spread to several other areas. France's history of police-related deaths has contributed to the anger over Traoré's death. And activists there are drawing on our Black Lives Matter movement to communicate their frustration. Emma Jacobs has our story.
Adama Traoré's family members have repeatedly challenged the official explanations of his death. Authorities first said the 24-year-old died from a heart attack, but later that he had a severe infection.
Mon frère a été tué. Il est mort, mon frère.
My brother was killed, said Assa Traoré last week. She spoke just before a march of about 2,000 people through their Paris suburb, saying her brother died on his birthday.
Il est mort dans des conditions atroces, seul.
He died in atrocious conditions, alone, without us. On his birthday, she said. I was overseas. I couldn't even give him a hug to wish him a happy birthday.
Traoré lived in a lower-income neighborhood outside the quaint core of Beaumont-sur-Oise. Caroline Vivier, who came out to show her support, says tension between young people and the police is not new here.
There's always been a relationship of force, and today it's being felt even more. We're also thinking of what's happening in the U.S. Unfortunately, we're connecting these incidents.
The next day, there is a scene elsewhere in France that could just as easily have taken place in the U.S. A crowd of protesters chanting Black Lives Matter come face to face with lines of riot police. But this is central Paris, at an event that had actually been planned weeks before Adama Traoré's death. It was supposed to be a march of solidarity, ending at the U.S. embassy. But now there's a greater sense of urgency for people here, like Fatih Cissé.
This happened close to home. We were already affected by the events in the U.S., and now this touches us even more.
Paris authorities revoked permission for the planned march, so the crowd of a few hundred people march around the plaza from blocked entrance to blocked entrance. The protesters also chant in French, "Justice for Adama." One of them is Fanny Essier, who describes herself as an Afro-feminist.
In the U.S., it's true, there are guns, so the violence there is more direct, more brutal, more spectacular. But there's also police violence in French neighborhoods.
She ticks off a number of names of other young men of color, including two who died during a police pursuit that sparked rolling riots in 2005. That violence shook the country, and it's what many people think of when they see images of cars burning in Beaumont-sur-Oise. Essier, like Adama Traoré, is 24, and she also has a brother, who she says is regularly stopped by police.
He was stopped once by police seven times in a day, even though he doesn't smoke. He doesn't drink, etc. And I have white friends who drink and smoke, who smoke illegal substances, and they're never stopped. And I say, well, that's bizarre.
She says the Black Lives Matter movement in the U.S. didn't kick off this conversation in France about police violence, but it's energized it. Plus, the slogan, Black Lives Matter, draws a connection to racism in the U.S.
The French media are always interested in questions of racism in the U.S. They don't have any trouble identifying it and condemning it. But when it comes to France, no.
But making comparisons between race relations here in the U.S. can be sensitive. On one side of the square, a heated argument takes place between a man eating at a cafe and a group of young protesters. "You are creating divisions. You are creating racism," he tells them, and repeats, "This is not the United States." This is not an unusual attitude in France. There's a lot of criticism here of American-style identity politics. In contrast, France is supposed to be strictly egalitarian and theoretically colorblind. So there's an emphasis on downplaying differences. But many of these young Black activists believe this makes it difficult to deal with racial problems that do exist in France. A law student named Theodore Jean-Baptiste explains.
Today, we realize that the lives of Black people aren't treated the same way by the police and justice system as the life of someone from another community. While France doesn't officially recognize differences, we see a failure there because there is a difference in treatment.
He'll keep pushing for more media attention to Adama Traoré's death, he says, until justice is done. The next step in Traoré's case will be a new autopsy requested by the family. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Paris.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. So happy today to have a familiar voice back on our show, stand-up comic and actor Hari Kondabolu.
Like, I don't like being niched as a thing. I'm a mainstream American comic, man. I've been on Letterman, Conan, Kimmel, Comedy Central. I've been in a shitty Sandra Bullock movie.
Mainstream American comic, Hari Kondabolu. That's also the name of his latest album, Mainstream American Comic. Before we go there, Hari, I got to ask, which Sandra Bullock movie were you in?
I was in the classic All About Steve. Some of you might have seen it on airplanes or perhaps on TBS very late at night. Yeah.
So let me get back to what we just heard there, that excerpt from your new album, Mainstream American Comic. You're talking about how you've been niched as a comic. And yeah, there is one a really horrendous episode from a gig you were doing at Skidmore College. We'll hear that and then we'll talk.
This is how they described my show that night. Rice, laughs, and curry sauce. Oh, there's more. There's more. Hari's coming to spice it up with his own special blend of South Asian humor. Ready to laugh till you're spewing curry from your nose? And then I had to tell jokes as a human being and not the cartoon they were clearly expecting, right?
Wow, that sounds brutal. How did that gig go?
Not that great. I mean, I didn't lead up to their expectations since I was multidimensional. Well, first of all, getting niched as just anything is awful, but also to be connected to food is kind of strange and disturbing. Like my humanity isn't enough.
Is there a lack of language to describe kind of what you do?
I think comedian is pretty good as a description.
right.
Funny has been good historically. I get a lot of smart, which is fine, but if it's not funny, it bums me out. I mean, I think for me, I get the branding elements of writing political comedian or activist comedian or social justice comedian or brown comedian or Indian comedian, whatever. I get the branding aspects of it, but like I guess that's why I named the album Mainstream American Comic. All those little identities are part of a larger picture of America and are integral to this country. So why do I have to be separated from the mainstream when the things I'm talking about are things that people deal with in this country?
Hari, how do you even define mainstream in comedy, especially these days?
I mean, that's another thing. It's harder and harder to do that just because, you know, there was a time where you had gatekeepers, whether it was club owners, whether it was networks, that chose you. You did Carson. Somebody chose you. And then Carson chose you. Then everybody chose you because Carson chose you. Those days are done, you know? Like, at this point, the people with the money come to you because you have a following. It's not generosity. Diversity isn't because of generosity. It's because they finally found diversity to be a commodity.
Let's talk about a bit you did on Black Lives Matter, and you're actually talking about the phrase all lives matter that some people have used as a retort to the Black Lives Matter movement. And I think listeners will agree that your bit kind of breaks down the ridiculousness of the rhetoric.
All lives matter. Do you guys how ridiculous you sound? That's like if it's your birthday and everybody's wishing you a happy birthday, then all of a sudden one person's like, you know, I also have a birthday. Shut the fuck up, Melissa! It's not about your birthday, Melissa. It's always your birthday, Melissa.
I hope the Melissas out there didn't take that too personally.
I lost my Melissa audience off that. Yeah.
You did get some pretty nasty trolling from that routine, though, from what I understand.
Yeah, I've been getting death threats over the last...
Death threats, really?
Yeah, which is, I'm used to that. I mean, internet death threats over the last, like, you know,
that
five, 6 years. Often enough, you know, people are upset because they think saying Black Lives Matter is going after white people, and it's not. Basically, if there's a word missing, it basically is Black Lives Also Matter, because historically we've seen they haven't. But Black Lives Matter, I think, just sounded better for branding. It just sounds stronger as opposed to Black Lives Also Matter.
Like,
it,
you know, right.
But it's not really about people being confused about it. It's just – it's anti-blackness and it's racist and it's a feeling that we're getting left out. No, you're not getting left out. This country has been built for white people. Like literally, like black people as slaves built this for white people.
There did seem to be a lot of people out there who, when they came out with All Lives Matter, felt like they were being fair in saying that and taken aback when that statement was put in check. And talk about that.
There's this feeling that all lives matter, which is a truth, that which Black Lives Matter would not disagree with. It's that all lives matter is rhetoric. It's not an actual movement. Because if it was an actual movement, they would be on the front lines with all the people at Black Lives Matter, based on that logic. Mm. And they would be fighting for things that are just – why aren't they fighting for universal health care? Issues that involve all our lives – It's not about all lives mattering when people say that. It's a way to go after black people in this movement. It has nothing to do with the actual ideas behind lives mattering.
You've been doing stand-up since you were 17. How has your comedy evolved over that time?
I'm definitely more honest. I think this album in particular, the new one, Mainstream American Comic, is definitely more personal. You know, instead of talking about immigrant struggle as an abstract concept, I talk about it in a personal way, about my own family. To not just rant about a thing, as I've done for a good chunk of this interview, but but to also see the actual human connections and the human ideas and the people that are affected by the things that bother me. I mean, a sense of humor is a defense mechanism, right? It's a way to protect us. And I feel like I use my defense mechanism as a career. Like, it's a way to deal with the world publicly, but it's still defense. I'm still having a hard time justifying the world we live in, and this is my way of coping with it.
What about your own background? Which of your parents gave you the funny bone?
Oh, yeah, my mom. Yeah, I hesitated out of respect for my dad.
Is it clear?
But it's my mom. She's extremely witty. She's so quick. For years, I don't think I gave her enough credit, as if, like, you know, I was like, oh, my brother and I, we grew up together watching TV and laughing. And I'm like, where did that develop? How did our ability to analyze things and cope with any kind of pain of any sort in our lives, how did that, you know, come to be? And that's my mom. My mom has always had a very sharp, very dark sense of humor.
Like a lot of us, I've taken my mom for granted. So recently, I decided to make a list of all the funny things my mom has been saying. First thing, I called my mom and I said, hey, mom, sorry I didn't call earlier this week. And she said, it's okay. It was a relief.
I know my mom's hysterical, but a lot of people wouldn't by looking at her, because the idea of an immigrant woman, an immigrant Indian woman being hilarious, I think is a real foreign concept to a lot of people.
What did she think of the album? Because she kind of, you mentioned
her. Oh, she's never going to listen to that album.
Why not?
She's not. I know my mom. Whenever I tell my mom, mom, did you read this article, or did you, even if I told my mom I was on the World today, and she would probably say, I don't know what that is. I have a real job, and I'm old, and I'm still working. She gives me perspective.
Well, I'll send you a station list. We've got to get her listening to the World. Comedian Hari Kondabolu, his latest album, Mainstream American Comic, is out now. Thank you. Great to speak with you again.
Great to talk to you too, man. Thank you.
And that is all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.